Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program for Friday, October the 15th, 2021. I'm your host, Robert. On today's program, 9 billion, with a B, chickens are slaughtered each year in the United States for food. Today we'll hear from Karen Davis, the founder of United Poultry Concerns. We'll look at the situation for chickens in the United States and why this issue would be an issue of peace and justice. So stick around. We'll be back in just a minute. Each year, 9.3 billion chickens are killed for meat in the United States alone. Globally, the figure is even more staggering at 72 billion. These chickens live out their entire brutish and short lives in what is best described as a toxic environment. They are subjected to genetic manipulation and live under enormous psychological, physiological, and emotional stress. My guest, Karen Davis, describes these conditions as a form of genocide, writing, "A concept of genocide in which physical, cultural, and ideological forms of victim annihilation are comprised allows us to consider humanity's relentless wholesale assault on the individuals, families, and communities and bodies of other animal species as a genocidal project, both in its own right and in the context of organized genocidal assaults by human populations on one another. Just as it makes sense to speak of a genocidal relationship implemented through racism, so it makes sense to speak of genocidal relationships implemented through speciesism in the myriad examples of humankind's conquest of non-human animals and their living space." Karen Davis, PhD, is the president and founder of United Poultry Concerns, a nonprofit organization that promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl, including a sanctuary for chickens in Virginia, inducted into the National Animal Rights Hall of Fame for outstanding contributions to animal liberation. Karen is the author of numerous books, essays, articles, and campaigns. Karen's books include a children's book titled A Home for Henny, a cookbook titled Instead of Chicken, Instead of Turkey, A Poultryless Poultry Potpourri, Prison Chickens, Poisoned Eggs, An Inside Look at the Modern Poultry Industry, More Than a Meal, The Turkey in History, Myth, Ritual, and Reality, and The Holocaust and the Handmaid's Tale, A Case for Comparing Atrocities. The 2009 revised edition of Karen's landmark book, Prisoned Chickens, Poisoned Eggs, first published in 1996, is described by the American Library Association's Choice magazine as, quote, riveting, brilliant, noteworthy for its breadth and depth. Karen's latest book is For the Birds, From Exploitation to Liberation, Essays on Chickens, Turkeys, and Other Domesticated Fowl. Karen Davis, it is my great honor to welcome you to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Thank you, Robert. The honor is mine as well. Thank you so much.
You have dedicated your life to the compassionate treatment and the sanctuary of domestic fowl, in particular chickens. How did you get to this place?
Well, Robert, several things happened. I was finishing my PhD dissertation at the University of Maryland in College Park. And that was right at the time that the animal rights movement, that is in the mid-1980s, was really getting started. In the Washington, D.C. area, you had People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, you had farm animal reform movement, you had the Fund for Animals, the Humane Society of the United States, and all of these animal advocacy organizations were clustered around Washington, D.C. and in Montgomery County, which is the suburb outside Washington. So my then husband, and who has since passed away, and I rented a little house in a little town called Darnestown, Maryland, outside Washington. And it turned out that our landlady had raised chickens for years and slaughtered them on her property. She no longer lived there, but we rented this little, like a little bungalow there. At the same time, I started participating in some of the protest demonstrations that were being organized in the Washington, D.C. area on behalf of various animals. And I was kind of an apprentice, I guess I would say. And I learned about Farm Sanctuary, which is now a huge enterprise on both the East Coast and the West Coast. But at that time, they were just a small operation in Avondale, Pennsylvania, which is known as the mushroom capital of the world. They do have great shiitake mushrooms there, as I learned when I became a volunteer, and would drive to Farm Sanctuary and ultimately spent 6 weeks there in the mid-1980s as a volunteer intern. And that's really where I got to know chickens. I was reading increasingly into animal rights literature, well, really historical literature about the mistreatment of all kinds of animals that goes way, way back. It didn't just start in the mid-20th century with factory farming, but I was educating myself and through reading, but I was also learning about farmed animals in particular through my experience at Farm Sanctuary. And I have a lifelong affinity for birds. I've loved birds all my life, although I did not grow up around birds used in food production. So when I met chickens and turkeys and ducks, I naturally gravitated particularly to them. I just really, really loved the birds. And I spent as much time with them as I could. At the same time, in the mid-1980s, our landlady had her chickens, who she had in a kind of little shed a few yards beyond the little house. She would have them rounded up, and there were about 100 of them, and she would have them rounded up, and I knew by that time that they were going to slaughter. And 2 years in a row, she left one hen behind, whether by accident or deliberately. And in both of those years, I brought the hen, first Viva and then Tulip, into our home and cared for them and got to know them as individuals. And the story of Viva is right on our homepage. It's the story of what I call our foundational chicken, who became foundational to the organization I founded in 1990, United Poultry Concerns. So my love for birds, my experience working at Farm Sanctuary, and just getting involved in the animal rights movement, which was so vibrant in the Washington, D.C. area in the mid-1980s, all of those things came together. And really what happened was that I had planned to teach English literature and composition for the rest of my life, but I got diverted to animals and animal rights and ultimately to farmed animals in particular, and even more in particular to the birds, who constitute the largest number of land animals being raised and slaughtered for food in the United States and throughout the world. The numbers are horrendous. They're in the many billions every year.
Well, Karen Davis, can you describe the sanctuary there?
Sure. Well, we have 12,000 square feet of sanctuary comprising two large yards and smaller enclosed yards with their own little houses. So we have 12,000 square feet, and in 2014, we actually did create an outdoor predator-proof aviary so that our chickens and our peafowl, we have a peahen and a peacock, could sleep and roost in the trees and the bushes if they liked. We have a great sanctuary maintenance man named Wayne Wills, who's been with us since 2007, and a wonderful five-day-a-week sanctuary helper assistant named Paul Conan, both of whom are local. And they do most of the work, certainly during the weekdays. And then I do the sanctuary work on Saturdays and Sundays. So we have very good, reliable help here. And it's a joy to be with the birds, but it is also labor intensive. And I always tell people who are saying, oh, how they'd love to start a sanctuary, including a man who visited here yesterday and was eager to look at our predator-proof enclosure, which is all outdoors, but all safe from foxes and raccoons and hawks and other chicken predators. And he was eager to see how this structure had been constructed and just meet our birds and see what we have going here. And I told him, as I've told so many people, that it is a labor-intensive job. You have to get up and get out there to work. If your help doesn't come in, you have to go out there and do it yourself. You have to be ready to take sick birds to the veterinary hospital if need be and administer medications sometimes, because birds get sick just like other, like we do or like your dog or cat does. And they require and they deserve medical care. So the point is, you have to be willing to be physically active, and you have to be willing to put up with the what I would call vicissitudes of having helpers. Some days they might not be able to come in out of illness or a sudden emergency or something. But basically, at least here in our sanctuary, our assistants are very, very reliable. And through all the years that we've been here, we've had wonderful sanctuary help.
Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by Chico Performances, presenting David Sedaris on Tuesday, November 2nd, at Laxon Auditorium. David Sedaris, one of America's preeminent humor writers, is beloved for his personal essays, short stories, and as a master of satire. Tickets at the University Box Office, 898-6333, or at chicoperformances.com. We're speaking today with Karen Davis, PhD, who is the president and founder of United Poultry Concerns, a nonprofit organization that promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl, including a sanctuary for chickens in Virginia that Karen was just describing. Can you describe, you know, for people who don't, maybe the only interaction they have with chickens is at the supermarket in a package, tell us a little bit about the capacities, the personalities of the chickens?
Well, first of all, chickens come from the tropical forests of Southeast Asia and the Himalayan mountains. So they have wild ancestors and contemporary relatives living in the tropical forests to this very day, the very tropical forests that are being eroded in part to grow soybeans for the fast food chicken industry. So the chickens that have been domesticated for the food industry and who are used for cockfighting, despite things that have been done to them, punitive things, terrible things that have been done to their bodies and their minds by abusers, chickens have the same essential nature as their wild relatives. And what this means is that, first of all, they are very social creatures. They like to be amongst themselves in large extended family groups. And they will then break up into smaller groups throughout the day. They do this in the tropical forest, and they do it right here in our sanctuary. Little groups form to take sun baths and dust baths. A dust bath is how a chicken cleans him or herself and practices bodily hygiene. It's comparable to a water bath that we take. And it's also a very sensuous experience for chickens. They love it. It also helps to keep them cool in hot, humid weather. And it's a social activity, because when one chicken starts to take a dust bath, that is to use their claws and their beaks to create a dust bowl to kind of wallow in for 20 minutes or so, then the other chickens, or many other chickens, will gradually join the first one or two, and then there will be a whole group of chickens all taking their dust baths. And similarly, chickens need sunlight. And again, their need for sunlight connects with their socialization impulses. So one hen will like lie down on the ground on her side, and she will fan out one wing and lift up her feathers so that the sunlight can penetrate to her skin. And then other chickens will come and lie down beside her and do the same thing. And then they will turn over and they will raise up the other wing and the feathers on the other side and allow the sunshine to penetrate their skin, into their skin. And in the winter, when there's very little sunlight and the days are very short, the chickens will follow the sun around the yard. And they will stand in the spot where the sunlight is. Chickens are sun-loving birds, even at the same time as they love to be in a forest-like environment where it's darker. And we provide all of those opportunities. We have two big open yards in our predator-proof aviary. And we also have wooded areas so that they can go into the darker tree-filled, bushes-filled areas where they like to sit and they just like to be. So, you know, chickens love the foresty kind of environment that we provide, and they also like the open yard where they get plenty of sunlight. Chickens love to be together, and they also tend to bond very well with other species, including human beings. Many chickens enjoy being picked up and stroked and petted. They're very sensuous. Their skin is extremely sensitive. Their beaks are very sensitive. They enjoy being petted. Some chickens do not want to be picked up, but that doesn't mean they don't want to be around you. They do want to be around you. Of course, they like treats. They like knowing they're going to get special treats. And when I walk outside down the steps, down the back steps, they'll run up to me in the evening. They want those peanuts, or they want that whole grain bread along with their regular food. So there's that. But the thing is, if you sit outside with them, they'll just gather around you and they like to be with you. And of course, I like to be with them. The idea that chickens are stupid or dirty, that the ignorant cliches characterize them as being, has nothing to do with who a chicken is. Sometimes, for example, you'll hear people say, oh, well, you know, a chicken who's pecking at the face of another chicken is cannibalistic, or they're acting, it's, look how aggressive they are with each other. But what people who say that don't understand, and this includes people in the poultry industry, is that chickens groom each other's faces, because obviously a chicken cannot groom her own or his own face. So just like mammals do, a chicken will see some kind of debris or maybe a little bug or something, and they'll very gently pluck it off the face of their companion. And their companion will stand stock still and allow that to be done, because again, it is grooming. It has nothing to do with aggression, except toward the little mites that might be the victims of that. But it's not aggression toward one another. Chickens basically get along very well together. They have to, as social animals. All social animals have to basically get along together. Occasionally, not only the roosters, but some hens will get into a little fight with each other. It usually doesn't last long. It's some issue that arises between them that I can't really decipher, but they have their own issues. They communicate things to each other that I understand sometimes, and other times I realize that this is amongst themselves, and I'm not privy to all that's happening between them. But I have to assure you that what I have experienced with chickens, their intelligence, their extreme alertness, their excellent hearing, has been confirmed by cognitive animal scientists, even poultry scientists. Even though poultry scientists are working for the industry, some of them will write papers or give presentations in which they completely scuttle the whole notion that chickens and turkeys are dumb, or that they're dirty. So there's a huge amount of scientific literature that confirms my daily experience with chickens and that of other sanctuary people, that they're amazingly aware, they are intelligent, they make decisions that benefit themselves. And you cannot be stupid and survive. Certainly not survive for tens of thousands of years as chickens have done. So they can't be stupid and still raise their families and deal successfully with predators and find food and deal with all the many, many things that even a stable environment creates as a form of novelty each and every day. So my experience with chickens is they're quite smart. They're quite emotional. I mean, roosters like Rupert, who's right outside my window, he's a very emotional bird. He is very excited. He does a dance around me every time I go into his enclosure, and he's dancing around me. He's all excited that I'm there. He jumps up on his perch so that I'll pet his back and stroke his feathers. And, they're very amiable creatures. And it's so sad and so wrong that they are so misunderstood and so maligned, because the, I guess what I'd call the popular perception of chickens is has nothing to do with who they are.
I'm speaking with Karen Davis, PhD. Karen is the president and founder of United Poultry Concerns, a nonprofit organization that promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl, including a sanctuary for chickens in Virginia, where I'm speaking with her via Zoom. In the United States alone, over 9 billion chickens per year are slaughtered for food. The figures are atrocious, and the daily lives of these sensitive creatures are nothing short of horrific. What is life like for them in a, quote, factory farm?
Well, as I mentioned, chickens love sunlight. They like to be active. They like to perch high off the ground, especially at night. They love to run around and be doing things and being active all day long. So chickens on industrial farms, where the majority of chickens are now confined, including in our region of the country here on the eastern shore of Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware, where at any given time over 500 million chickens are incarcerated in dark, long metal sheds, 600-foot long sheds. And when you drive up and down the main road here, and the roads that go off into the more rural areas, when you see these sheds, if you don't know what you're looking at, you would never guess that 20, 30, 40,000 baby chickens up to 5-6 weeks old, at which age they're slaughtered, are crowded inside these buildings. The buildings are kept just light enough for them to find their food and to drink from the nipple drinkers that hang from the ceiling. So they never even get to immerse their beaks in real water, which they love to do. They're in basically semi-darkness through their entire lives, and they are sedentary because they are so crowded they can't move by the time they are 2 weeks old. When they go in as baby chicks, they're very large, but the industry has a method of what is called forced rapid growth, which is a combination of genetics and other interventions through how they're fed and the lighting and so on, that forces them to put on an abnormal amount of weight of muscle tissue in a very, very short period of time, so that at the age of, let's say, a month old, a chicken who would weigh barely a pound weighs 5 pounds. Now, anybody can think about what that would be like for a human being to be forced to swell up, to be muscle bound, to have their internal organs in a deformed condition, because all of this has been done to them through genetic manipulation and other manipulations of their environment, so that they will, when they are slaughtered, they will have these huge breasts that is the main part of their body that people buy in this country. And in, I guess, Western countries also, although what are called chicken wings are also, everybody who is not a vegan or vegetarian thinks are so wonderful. Which, and actually they are not wings at all. They're the shoulder blades and God knows what other parts of chickens. So it's kind of interesting to think that not only are the chicken wings severed from the chickens, but what are called wings are not even wings. They're just another part of the body that is turned into some kind of a miscellany of stuff that with flavor enhancers and every type of thing to make it palatable, like a hot dog, which is a horrible thing to eat when you know what goes into a hot dog. These birds, they are essentially for the last month of their short life, they're slaughtered as chicks, as baby chicks, but they're just so huge. And even people here on the Eastern Shore often don't realize that these are baby chicks because they are so large. When they go up and down the roads in the trucks, they see them in the crates on the trucks, and they don't even realize that they're babies. Not that it would be better if they were adults, but just to understand that when people eat chicken, what they call chicken, they're eating baby birds. So the birds are kept in semi-darkness. These factory farm buildings, these industrial buildings, are just loaded with pathogens, that is disease-causing microorganisms. When you have slum conditions, you have disease organisms proliferating, and that's what the chickens live in. There's Salmonella, Campylobacter, Listeria, all kinds of parasites. They're living in a toxic waste environment because when the droppings or the excrement of chickens or other birds or really any animals who have a uric acid component, when they are in a situation where they're eliminating their feces and the feces are just accumulating and never being cleaned out, then the uric acid, in the case of chickens, in being decomposed by bacteria, lets out ammonia fumes. And ammonia fumes, for anybody who has ever smelled an atmosphere dense with ammonia fumes, knows how they burn your eyes, they burn your lungs. Even a chicken house that has been emptied out for, let's say, several days or a week, if you open that door, those ammonia fumes, plus many other toxic environmental or atmospheric fumes, hit you in the, really, they hit you in the face, they hit you in the eyes and in the throat. And you just imagine a little bird living in a situation like that. Of course, this causes all kinds of diseases, respiratory infections. The birds have so many what they call diseases of production, diseases that chickens, and I have to say turkeys and ducks as well, would never experience, do not experience in their natural habitats of the tropical forests. So we have inscribed in these birds diseases that are a reflection of the human disease, really, the human sicknesses that of body and spirit that allow us to treat other creatures so abominably, so cruelly, and that in turn can make many people sick with bacterial foodborne poisoning, which many people think of as stomach flu, and don't even often understand that it is from eating polluted or contaminated birds, because their immune systems, the immune systems of birds who are living in these densely stressful environments, which chickens never evolved to learn to cope with, their immune systems can't cope with the overload of microorganisms that assault them, that are, they're breathing in, their mucous membranes can't handle the load. The chicken's eyes often go blind or partially blind from the dense ammonia fumes that causes a disease called keratoconjunctivitis in the birds. They have so many intestinal diseases, and they're just assaulted by a myriad of disease organisms. And that does not mean that you're not going to get a piece of the breast muscle tissue or a so-called wing or a leg that was not part of a bird in that condition or those conditions. Because again, these birds aren't just suffering from one or two disease conditions. They're suffering from multiple disease conditions all at the same time. And they, because they are forced to grow so large and so fast within just a few weeks, their bones haven't even solidified by the time they're sent to slaughter. Hence, they are crippled. The legs that people are eating are from birds who were often unable to get back up on their feet again after a week or so. They just can't hold their bodies up. Now, the industry, the poultry industry, doesn't care about that, because all they want them to do is turn into a mass of breast muscle tissue. And if they can't walk, that's fine, because when you're sedentary, you put on weight more quickly. And that's one of the other advantages from the industry point of view of crowding them, because if they're crowded, they can't move. And the industry doesn't want food to be, quote unquote, wasted into activity. They just want it to be turned into something edible that they can sell and make money from. And that's what they get. So then when the birds are grabbed in the middle of the night or also during the day, upside down by their very pain-filled legs, and thrown into the transport crates that are loaded onto the flatbed trucks that run up and down the roads here all day long, then they go to the slaughterhouse. We have a huge Tyson complex, what they call a processing complex, and a big Purdue poultry processing complex up the road from where we're located here in rural Virginia. And when they get to, the chickens are loaded into the slaughterhouses, again, they are treated so roughly by the workers who have to maintain speed always. So they have to grab them upside down, throw them into the shackles upside down. Then the chickens go through what is probably the worst experience of all, which is electrified splashing salt water. And the purpose of that is not to stun the birds, although the industry uses that term. And unfortunately, the animal advocacy movement uses that term too, but it's a complete a misuse of the term to describe the actuality. The actuality is that when the industry uses the term stun, what they mean is immobilization or paralysis of the muscle tissue. They want the birds to be fully alive. They want the birds to be paralyzed in order to fit them to the machinery so they're not flopping around, and also because that loosens the pores in their skin that enables the feathers to come out more easily after the birds are finally dead. So the electrified water bath that they're dragged through is pure torture. And then they go to an automated neck cutter, which is intended to partially slit their throats while keeping them alive and keeping their hearts beating. And the automated neck cutter might also include a manual, that is a man who's sitting there cutting their throats in case they miss the neck cutter. And then they go on still alive, their hearts still beating, still in agony from the electrified water, and now they're agonizingly cut throats. They go to what's called a bleed out chamber. They bleed out for 90 seconds, and then dead or alive, they are thrown into a scald water tank. And has been as has been described by slaughterers, in the slaughter or in the scald water tank, very, very hot water, those who are still alive struggle and break their bones, and their eyes pop out of their heads in the agony. And you can even hear them peeping as they are thrown into these tanks. So you can't treat a creature with more total cruelty than chickens are treated by the industry, who doesn't care about them at all, and who only cares about having enough birds that they can sell, and they will cut off all the portions that include bruises and infections and you name it, so that they can sell what looks like something that people will buy. Again, it doesn't get any more brutal, crueler, or more horrible for a sentient creature to endure than what these chickens and turkeys and ducks are enduring by the millions every single, really, every day.
Today I'm speaking with Karen Davis, PhD. Karen is the founder and the president of United Poultry Concerns, a nonprofit organization that promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl, including a sanctuary for chickens in Virginia. The conditions that you described, I believe, are what the industry refers to as broiler chickens. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about the laying hens, a chicken who is there to produce eggs for the industry. What's that look like?
Well, first of all, in the mid-20th century, two different types of what they called utility chickens were bred for specific characteristics. The chickens the industry calls broiler chickens are the ones I've just been describing, who are bred for fast, rapid growth to a huge size in a short amount of time, whereas the hens used for the egg industry have been bred to be as small and compact as possible while still ensuring an abnormal number of eggs being laid by each hen. So in the 20th century, hens used for egg production were bred and inbred and crossbred and you name it, so that each hen would lay between 250 and 300 eggs a year, which in nature would never happen because, for example, the chicken's ancestor in the tropical forests may lay two dozen eggs per year. In the spring, they'll lay a dozen eggs and who will be hatched into chicks. And then in the early summer, they'll lay 10 or 12 eggs, and those eggs will hatch, and then they'll raise those chickens and or those chicks into adults, and then that's all the egg laying they do. So we're talking about going from, let's say, two dozen eggs per hen per year to 250 to 300 per year. So naturally, this puts an enormous burden on the bird, and particularly on their reproductive system, which causes them to be very susceptible to reproductive tumors, to eggs ganging up inside their oviduct, and often causing them to develop impactions, where there's just all this eggshell and egg yolk and egg white and all of that, and because their bodies keep making more eggs. The industry back in the 1930s was proud to say, the egg industry, that we are creating egg-laying machines. And that's what the bird experiences almost, except they're not a machine. They're a sensitive living creature who has the burden of all of this going on inside their bodies, apart from anything they would choose to do or to experience. So then in the conditions in which they're raised, which for the most part is still cages, cage facilities where the birds, maybe 10 birds or 8 or 10 or more, are squeezed into little cages in buildings where from floor to ceiling, there are nothing but cages full of hens. There are also what are increasingly known as cage-free or uncaged facilities, where the hens are not in cages, although they're completely confined in an enclosure. They may have, in addition to being crowded on the floors of the enclosure, they may have platforms. And the idea of platforms is to be able to crowd even more birds into the volume of space they occupy. They might have a little nest box, which is usually plastic. I've visited several of these cage-free operations, and they usually have some type of a plastic nest box to get into. Now, as bad as cage-free or uncaged facilities are, and again, they're full of ammonia fumes and the usual things that happen when you crowd creatures together unnaturally in a way that nature never intended for them to live. But if you're going to compare the cage situation versus the uncaged situation, the uncaged housing is better than the cage one, because the cages are just the worst. I mean, life couldn't be worse than to be unable to move your body, to be stuffed into cages in a world of nothing but cages and tortured cage mates, not only inside your cage, but under you, beside you, and stretching farther than the eye can see. And these uncaged facilities, if you look down the aisles, you really can't even begin to see to the end of the aisle because of the density of the microscopic pathogens, the microorganisms, and just the general toxic gaseous environment that the birds are living in. So again, it's a matter of not what is more humane, but what is less inhumane. That's as good as it gets. But again, these living conditions are so sad because chickens just, they want to be outside. And when they want to be in the earth. They want to scratch around and take their dust baths, as I mentioned earlier. They want natural sunlight. And that isn't just something they desire to have. That is something that is embedded in their genetic makeup. So that when you hear people say, well, if they never knew any different, then they don't really suffer. And my response to that is saying, well, if a baby is born with an addiction to heroin or cocaine because his or her mother was addicted, they don't really suffer because that's all they ever knew was being an addict. A child born into human slavery. Well, you could say, well, all they've ever known is slavery, so they're not really suffering since they don't have an alternative form of existence. But of course they know, their whole being knows. And, you know, the body of a chicken, like a human being or anybody else, the lungs, the intestines, knows what kind of an environment they're supposed to have. They know. And can distinguish between that and a toxic experience that they're trying to cope with, the very bodily organs. They quote unquote know the difference between being assaulted by inimical conditions versus having a life where there's fresh air and sunshine and all the things that the organism that they support, the being they support, would choose. And one of the things that has always interested me when we have taken in hens from battery cage facilities or even from a cage-free operation is how as soon as they're placed on the ground, on the earth, for the first time in their lives, and of course they're bewildered and all of that, but they so readily make sense of an environment that speaks to who they are. And one of the very first things, if not the first thing they will do, is they will start to scratch in the ground and they will start to peck at the ground and they will start to make a dust bowl or an earth bowl. And they want to clean their body. They want to practice hygiene. And of course, that's another thing. All of these birds who are locked up in these confinement operations, they never can practice hygiene. They never can clean themselves. They always feel dirty. And the hens, when they come from these facilities where they never were on the ground before and never had a chance to really preen and clean themselves properly, they just immediately respond to the stimulus of an earthy opportunity. And they start taking their dust baths. And that is so refreshing to them. And I think that once they've had a real good dust bath, then they are ready to start having a good life of exploring. And they learn quite rapidly. When I've placed chickens in our sanctuary, who never knew anything but confinement indoors, it's amazing how quickly they learn. They learn how to drink water from a bowl, even though all they ever knew before was a nipple drinker hanging from the ceiling that allowed one drop at a time to come out. But they recognize water. They recognize sunlight. They know all these things because all of these features, environmental features, are embedded in their genetic makeup.
Peace and social justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook and at 762-1490. Peace and social justice is also made possible by Take Your Shoes Off Foot and Body Massage, offering massage therapy at two Chico locations, with 30 to 100 minute massage care for your body, feet, or a combination of both. Gift certificates and specials are also available. Located in the Safeway Plaza with walk-ins welcome or by appointment at 676 Mangrove Avenue. The number there is 530-715-4811 and at 1354 East Avenue, Suite D. The number there, 530-809-6907. I'm speaking with Karen Davis, the founder and president of United Poultry Concerns. Karen, now, here's what I'm curious about. So there are people listening to this program who hear the conditions that you're describing. They say, look, I'm on board with you. I'm totally against this kind of treatment. I'm against this, quote, factory farm type of production facility. I'm against these kinds of hatcheries. And because of that, that's why I go to my local co-op and I buy only free range eggs and I buy just local chicken, you know. So it doesn't seem to me that I need to be a vegan or a vegetarian. What I need to do is just not contribute to these industrial practices, Karen, that you're describing, so that the chickens that I eat or the eggs that I eat, basically these chickens, as I've heard it described, they'll say, look, these chickens live an idyllic life and then they have this one bad day at slaughter. And so I really don't feel any ethical compulsion to give up eating chicken or give up eating eggs. What kind of response? Because a lot of our listeners do feel that, you know, I don't want to contribute to the industrial production, quote, production of chicken, but, you know, I'm supporting local egg producers and local chicken producers. What's your response to those kinds of, you know, those kinds of arguments?
Well, one thing people need to know is that the chickens that they buy and consider local, or the eggs, often come from industrial factory farm hatcheries. And local farmers will purchase the chickens, who are then flown through the postal service, the U.S. Post Office, to their farms to be raised and sold, raised, slaughtered, and sold to local buyers. But that it doesn't mean that that's where they originally came from. Many farmers buy their birds from the Midwestern hatcheries, which are factory farms. And in fact, these factory farm hatcheries, they sell every type of bird you want to mention and to anybody. And they sell quails, they sell all types of pheasants, chickens, turkeys, ducks, any type of duck you want. They sell to cockfighters and everybody else. So, I mean, there's no ethical component there where many of these birds originate. So what's called local isn't necessarily always local. I want to give an example of, in Virginia, for example, a place that Michael Pollan extolled as a humane alternative to so-called factory farming. And I say it's all factory farming, really, when you get down to the attitudes and the actual conditions and behavior of people toward their animals, their birds. But Michael Pollan, he celebrated this Virginia local farm called Polyface, which still exists. And Polyface is considered a local farm and people like to buy locally. But in fact, Joel Salatin, who is the founder and head of Polyface, he buys his birds from the Midwestern hatcheries, from McMurray Hatchery. So they're not really local. And for every hen that lays an egg in one of these so-called local farms or backyard chicken farms, whatever, there's a male chick who was ground up alive in the hatchery as soon as he struggled out of his shell. Millions of them, something like 7 billion worldwide, 250 in the United States per year, we're talking about, per year or more. So you've got the fact that the brothers of these happy hens were destroyed after they grew inside the shell and came out of the shell, and they were either suffocated with carbon dioxide in plastic bags, which is a horrible way to die, or they are on these conveyor belts that just take them straight into a grinder, which is called a macerator. It grinds them up as soon as they're born, and they go into poultry feed and so-called livestock feed and pet food. So many farmers are reluctant to use veterinarians for sick birds or other animals, cows, for example. They consider it cheaper to just let them die than to engage a veterinarian to give veterinary aid to a bird who has respiratory infection, which could be treated with antibiotics. There's this whole, again, if you're in the business of live creatures, you want to cut costs and make money. That's what you're in it for. So you're not going to spend any money that you don't have to spend. That's just the nature of business. So certainly the capitalist paradigm, which includes live animal production, is to reduce your costs and maximize your profits. So veterinary care can be expensive. Medications can be expensive. So they are only, whether they're local farmers or backyard, so-called backyard chicken keepers, or the big industrial chicken producers, they are only going to do what costs the least amount of money, but still maximizes their profit. So I have talked to, by email and on the phone, to many, many local farmers and backyard chicken keepers for whom the idea of engaging a veterinarian for their birds is, they consider that outlandish. They'll say, well, it's cheaper to get a new chicken than it is to save one for another, you know, another half a year or so, because most of these local people are, they're only going to keep their hens, for example, for about maybe a year, year and a half, and then they're going to send them to slaughter, or they're going to slaughter them on site. So consider that a chicken can live, believe it or not, up to 30 years, and if to the extent that they're like the jungle fowl, close to nature with few or no manipulations by humans, or even chickens who are used and bred and manipulated by people, they can still live 7 or 10 years or so, except for the chickens who are bred for meat production, because they have heart attacks as babies. They are so fragile. They are so fragile. But chickens can live 10, 12 years or so. But the egg producers, whether they're factory farm egg producers or local egg producers, after the hens have been laying eggs for about a year or so, then they want to get rid of them because they're no longer productive. Now, one thing that happens is that in the winter, chickens naturally lay fewer eggs because their bodies are supposed to get a rest. Nature wants their bodies and their reproductive systems to rest and prepare for the next round of egg laying in the spring and summer and the raising of chicks and all of that. So people who keep chickens are then ready to get rid of their birds because they don't want to have to feed them through a winter where they're not going to get the eggs. So they want to get rid of them, and some of them will just simply discard the birds here, there, or everywhere. Or some of them who are more responsible will contact people like us or other sanctuaries that they learn about and say, well, can you take my birds? They're old now. That's the industry term, whether it's local or large scale industrial. They're old now, even though they're barely barely 2 years old, if that much. They're old hens or they're spent hens. And so we don't want them anymore. And would you like to have them? So that's what the more responsible local chicken keepers do. Others will, I guess, just kill them on site. It's typical for local farmers to put their chickens in boxes, metal boxes, and take a hose full of carbon dioxide and just hose them to death. And again, it's a very slow, agonizing death because carbon dioxide is very, very painful to the lungs, and it both freezes, and burns their lungs. So there's another place here in Virginia called Black Eagle Farm that we learned about and visited back in 2011. And the owner there, poultry geneticist, whose name escapes me right now, he was quite a cavalier about it. He said, yeah, we throw them into boxes and the metal boxes, and we turn the hose on them. And some of them get out. And if they get out, they run around, and we use baseball bats on them. So, I mean, there's no morality. There's no compassion, really, in these businesses. And even if a person has some basic compassion when they go into the business, as a manager, an owner, whatever, they either become very hardened, they accommodate to the culture of production, or where you're not sentimental about the animals. You know, you have to be practical and all of that. Or if they're really offended, they get out of that business because they don't like what they have to do. They don't like what they see. So, again, people don't understand the processes of production. It's very apparent and very horrific when it comes to living creatures. But when we think about the fact that everything people buy, practically every commodity in every supermarket, clothing store, a pharmaceutical store, you name it, everything comes from what amounts to a factory farm, a global assembly line, sweatshops. And people don't even picture, understandably, they don't picture how these products, these glittering products, these humanely raised products came to be. They don't see the processes of production. So, and they don't really want to see it either. And the attitude is, well, what am I going to do? I have to buy stuff, and this is, you know, I'm sorry about that. But, and then again, people quickly revert to the sense of when it comes to live animals who have been slaughtered and the eggs, et cetera, when they learn about some of the facts, their attitude is, well, you know, they were brought, their food. They were brought into the world to be food. That's what they're here for. And so people have rationalizations to do what they want to do. I should say we do, because we're all complicit in rationalizing things we want to do to a certain extent. So we can sort of understand that. But again, when it comes to living creatures and the fact that there are so many alternatives to eating eggs and flesh of animals and the milk derived from nursing cows and goats and so on, that it becomes, well, what Matthew Scully described in his book Dominion. He said, what was once perhaps a quote unquote necessary evil is now just evil. So that's pretty much how I look at it. Again, you have to find ways to talk to people to get them to care about these animals and to understand that there's no free lunch here, morally speaking.
I'm speaking with Karen Davis, the founder and president of United Poultry Concerns. Let's take a little break, hear from one of our underwriters. Be back on the other side of this in just a minute.
Chico's favorite dog festival and walk is back this year. Join us for Walk Woof Wag on Saturday, October 30th from 9 to noon at Sycamore Field in Lower Bidwell Park for games and activities, a doggy costume contest, a group game of Simon Says Woof, pet psychics, pet photos, and more, plus a spirited walk through beautiful Lower Bidwell Park. All proceeds benefit the Chico Animal Shelter's medical fund to help them house, heal, and reunite dogs and cats with their owners or find them forever homes. Register to participate or sign up to volunteer, sponsor, or donate online at walkwoofwag.com or register in person on October 30th starting at 9 a.m. The whole family is welcome and participants can come with or without a dog. Go to walkwoofwag.com right now to sign up and get involved. We ask that all attendees please wear a mask and practice social distancing, regardless of vaccination status, for the safety of our community. See you on the field for a doggone fun time.
We're speaking today with Karen Davis, PhD, who is the president and founder of United Poultry Concerns, a nonprofit organization that promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl, including a sanctuary for chickens in Virginia. As a recognized hero of the animal rights movement, I'm wondering if you can reflect a little bit about what you see as the biggest obstacles to social change vis-a-vis animal rights. What do you see as both the strengths and weaknesses of the animal rights movement now that you have so many years experience?
That's a very hard question because we're in the midst of the movement, which itself is only, 50, 60 years old, going back to the 1970s, really. And so what I have seen over the past decades is a proliferation of smaller groups, of vegan groups, of vegan animal rights groups. So there are many more organizations, not only in the United States, but worldwide, including sanctuaries. And chicken sanctuaries, micro sanctuaries, have become very popular. And these micro sanctuaries provide a great opportunity for people in general to learn more about who chickens are, because the micro sanctuaries tend to focus on chickens. And so we have a very flourishing movement that connects saving chickens from abusive situations with a strong vegan message and an opportunity. If you can't visit the sanctuary directly, you can certainly visit the sanctuary by going online, by going to Facebook, and so on. An issue that has bedeviled the animal advocacy movement. I call it animal advocacy to sort of be as large and encompassing as possible. And so what I would say is that most everybody I know in the movement, I don't include the ASPCA or American Humane Association, because they're not truly animal advocacy organizations. But if you talk about animal advocacy organizations, virtually everyone I know and have worked with wants to see an end to animal exploitation. They want to see non-animal alternatives used in laboratories, in experimental research, or in production of medicines, etc. They want to see an end to not just factory farming, but animal farming. There's an increasing vegan movement that has taken some time to get off the ground. I mean, back in the 80s, the question was, should we even focus on farmed animals? Because people, including the heads of the big organizations, eat animals and they drink milk from nursing mammals and they eat eggs. And so, and 95% of all animals exploited by humans are farmed animals. So what do we do? So, for example, in the 80s, the whole focus at that time wasn't even on dairy cows, but it was on the calves, who were like the byproducts of the dairy industry and who were turned into what they call veal calves. So people thought that in the movement, thought that a focus on the veal calf would be a good campaign because, first of all, there are many fewer veal calves than chickens, and people tend to look at the sad eyes of a veal calf in a crate with more immediate visceral emotion than if they see a whole sea full of chickens or turkeys in a vast chicken or turkey complex. And then Peter Singer, he said, comparing the numbers of, like, I don't know, I can't remember anymore, 35,000 veal calves, for example, let's say, between versus what was then 7 billion chickens and many hundreds of millions of hens used for egg production. He said, really, the hens in battery cages should receive priority in our movement, because the veal calf is going to be dead at the end of, 14 weeks, 12 to 14 weeks, whereas the hen isn't even moved from the what they call the pullet cages into the battery cages until they're already several months old, and then they're going to live in battery cages for another year or so. They may be what's called force molted, where they're deprived of food for as long as 10 or days or 2 weeks, and then recycled back into egg production. And that might even happen with the dwindling number of hens in the cages, not just once, but twice, because the industry just wants to save money and not have to spend money on bringing up new chicks every year. And so today, the animal rights movement, the animal liberation movement, is solidly behind ending the exploitation of animals, period, whether it's circuses or other forms of entertainment, whether it's food production, whether it's animal research, or you name it. Now, the question is more not what we all want to ultimately accomplish, which is the abolition of animal suffering and abuse and birth to be abused and exploited at the hands of humans, but the issue is one of strategies. So that's where the arguments are come into play. And again, I don't have all the answers. I don't even pretend to have the answers for what's the best way to get people to care about animals and to stop wanting to use and abuse them and to help them become free to live as nature intended them to live as much as possible. So, for example, in the farmed animal component of the animal advocacy movement, the question is, well, do we work with farmers who want to raise animals, quote unquote, more humanely and slaughter them, of course, or send them to slaughter? Or will that help these animals? What about people who just will not hear the word vegan without shutting their ears and thinking that this is just a fringe a movement of people who want you to live on sprouts and tofu? Now, again, this is changing. I mean, the term vegan no longer has the total negative connotations in the larger public that it did back in the 80s and you know, through much of the 90s. People know what vegan means now, and more and more people are coming on board with veganism. You see products, even cosmetic products now, that proudly proclaim vegan. And you see all kinds of food products that now proudly proclaim on their labels vegan. Well, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, us animal rights people said, wouldn't it be great if we could get the food industry to actually put the term vegan on their vegan products? We thought that would be like a miracle to get something like that to happen. But you see, it's through our persistence that more and more people are looking for animal-free foods, and that have caused the animal production industries to want to meet those consumer desires for vegan food products. The plant-based movement, which we've helped to bring about as animal advocates. We have been pushing the plant-based message, and we're pushing it more and more successfully. So we have to, this is not the time to quit, to give up. I tell people, if you're saying, well, if I didn't think we could win, then I'm going to quit. Well, then my answer is quit. Because first of all, we're in for the long haul. This isn't a football game or a beauty contest. This is in for the, we're going to be at this for centuries. Okay. So accept it. Again, we can't even get human rights in place in this country or in the whole world yet after centuries of effort. But you don't see real social justice activists for humans saying, well, we failed. We don't have Jim Crow officially anymore, but we still have Jim Crow. So in essence, we might as well quit. It's a losing battle. For animal advocates to take that attitude is just that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you have a negative attitude, you are helping to ensure that animals never will be liberated and that people will never change. So I say, take a positive attitude. You can be pessimistic without being negative, if that makes sense. You can have a pessimistic viewpoint of the world as you see it. But the thing is, as an activist, you have to take an attitude of optimism and of positivity. That's what you have to do. So I've always liked the statement I saw once on the wall of the English department at the University of Maryland, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. So as an animal activist, you have to embody and practice optimism of the will. Otherwise, you can't be an advocate. Yeah, you can't speak in a way that is going to persuade people to want to join you. Veganism is, of course, about eliminating the use of animals as a food source and eating animal-free, but it is also a much larger philosophical and, if you will, spiritual movement to try to live according to really ahimsa, you know, a positive, nonviolent approach to life to the best of your ability. It's about doing as little harm as you can while you're on this earth. So it definitely includes how you eat and drink, but it is also a more encompassing view of how you choose to spend your time on this earth and spend your money. That's really what veganism is ultimately about.
Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Quiksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quiksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice. Right here in Chico, Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. Well, in wrapping up, Karen Davis, you founded United Poultry Concerns 31 years ago, and I'm wondering if you might reflect on what United Poultry Concerns has achieved in the course of those 31 years.
I feel very good about what United Poultry Concerns has achieved since we became an official nonprofit organization in October of 1990. Back in the early days, I was told by some of the then leaders of the animal advocacy movement that starting an organization for chickens was a bad idea because we can't even get people to care about whales. How are we ever going to get people to care about chickens? But my attitude then was, as advocates, we can't take that negative attitude. We have to take a positive attitude that we can tap into the compassionate part of people, into that part of people that is accessible to change. And that's our job as advocates. So our organization, United Poultry Concerns, has been very influential in educating not only the larger public, but also the animal advocacy movement about who chickens are. We understand their suffering and misery in the dystopian conditions we force them to live in for food production and in cockfighting, for example. But we understand their misery and the abusiveness they endure much better if we know who they are when they're not being abused and when they're not suffering and when they're living as they evolved in nature to live. So when you understand that chickens roost in trees at night, that they are forest dwellers by nature, and what we see here in our sanctuary and what we publicize, particularly since we created the outdoor predator-proof aviary, is how much chickens love to go into the trees and bushes. A lot of times, you know, people see the birds even in a sanctuary, only on the ground, or maybe only in a sort of a wood chips type of place. And I'm not criticizing sanctuaries for that, because, you know, every sanctuary has its own needs and so on. But the thing is, when you have what we have here now, particularly, and you hear the chickens rustling around in the trees at night, getting ready to settle down, and sometimes bumping each other off a branch that particular chicken wants to occupy, and you just see them under the trees and scratching away at the earth, and you get a sense of how much these birds, no matter how they've been genetically manipulated, resemble and have within themselves everything that their free-living wild ancestors and contemporary cousins embody in the tropical forests. And another thing about chickens is how many have been shown to become feral. That is, they were in some type of domesticated or confinement situation, and they got loose or free, and they can live very successfully on their own. You know, they quickly revert to their natural behavior. The problem with the chickens who have been bred specifically for industrial meat production and egg production is most of them are white, so they can't camouflage themselves. Some brown hens are used for commercial egg production, but the majority in this country, they're all snow white. So they can't really hide themselves in the trees if they're out there in a forest. And then of all of the so-called broiler chickens, who we tend to now call Cornish crosses, because the Cornish chicken is a basis of the modern so-called broiler chicken. And we think the word broiler is such an ugly term to apply to a poor little bird. So what you see in a sanctuary like ours is how, wherever they came from, if they came from a cockfighting background, or whether they're little tiny chickens called bantams, or they're silky chickens, or they come from the egg industry or the chicken meat industry, they're all chickens. And they all like a breeze. They like to sit in the breeze, and they like to be on the ground, and they like, if they can get up into trees and bushes for the night or even during the day, they like to go up there. And they socialize naturally and, for the most part, harmoniously with each other, because that's their nature. And when you see how they are when they're exercising their natural impulses and instincts and performing their natural activities as much as possible in a sanctuary like ours, you get a sense of who they really are. And then you see the sadness and the grimness of their lives, living in the dark, living in crowding, living where there's nothing, there's no joy, and there's no comfort at all. and yet they're forced to be there without escape except through death. How anybody wants to ingest that misery into themselves once they have an inkling of what they're doing, I will never understand.
Well, Karen Davis, if our listeners want to contact you or contact United Poultry Concerns or even possibly as a nonprofit contribute, how can they reach you? How can they get in touch with you?
People can reach us by going to our website, which is upc-online.org. And there you will see the wealth of information we have about chickens, turkeys, the poultry industry. We have wonderful vegan recipes under diet. We have information about health, health and nutrition, about the ethics of diet, great recipes under the recipe section. We have continuing updated alerts for various campaigns we've been conducting. One of our big campaigns that we've been conducting since March is against a tractor supply company, which has been using chicks for years and years to try to bring them into their various stores, which amount to about 2,000 almost in the United States, and which are everywhere. And this year in particular, they had a new type of containment conditions, which were completely horrible and which caused even the employees to complain about how awful they were. But the point is, they use these chicks by the thousands, which come from factory farms, in order to sell the equipment. The chicks, the people, the customers see the baby chicks and they say, oh, how cute, it's Easter, we'll buy some chicks. And in addition, now they're going to buy the brooders, the heat lamps, the poultry feed, the coops. That's where Tractor Supply and feed stores like them make all their money. It's not from the chicks. It's the chicks are used as bait to get people to buy the equipment to keep them. So it's a very cynical operation. And we've had a big campaign against Tractor Supply and urging people to contact Tractor Supply and say, we are not going to purchase any of your other products so long as you continue to sell baby chicks as well as baby ducklings and sometimes rabbits in order to sell all this equipment. So that's been one of our big campaigns. We have a big campaign on our website against the practice known as caporus, in which chickens are used in a horrifically cruel ritual, not only in New York City, but where groups of ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities are located in Brooklyn, where we focus our attention, but other parts of New York City, other parts of the country. And so we have been leaders in through our alliance to end chickens as caporas to educate the public. So we have, and of course, our ongoing campaigns are always to get people to go vegan, to educate people about the poultry and egg industries, to educate people about the horror of the cockfighting industry, because that's an industry too, to get parents and teachers to not hatch chicks in school hatching projects. So we try to cover all the bases, and I think we've done that pretty successfully over the years. And we urge people, please, to come to our website and see all the work that we are doing to educate people to want to change their attitude and behavior towards these truly wonderful birds, and to create a life where compassionate treatment, not only compassionate feelings, because sometimes compassionate feelings don't translate into compassionate action and treatment. So we talk about compassionate treatment and respectful treatment of our fellow creatures.
Well, Karen Davis, it has been a great honor and a tremendous pleasure to have you share your time with us here on the Peace and Social Justice Program. I want to thank you for taking the time to share your experience with us here on the show.
Robert, it's been an honor and a pleasure, and I thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, that does it for this week's Peace and Social Justice Program. Stick around for Playing Dead. Hope you have a wonderful week. Be kind to each other. We'll see you next week. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Jazz is dead there. Thank you. Hey, you know what tomorrow is, don't you? It's Bob Weir's birthday.
Oh, Bobby.
Yeah, Bobby's birthday tomorrow. My name's Ray. Welcome to Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 to 3. And you got it. We're going to be celebrating Bob's birthday today with a really, really sweet show.
Ray, I hate to ask you, how old is
Bobby? How old is Bobby? I believe he's 73.
Bob Weir,
70. I believe he is. And I had some facts on this, but we'll bring that up at the other part of the hour. Let's get to the music, because now I'm all confused. All right, let's thank some underwriters, and we'll get right to the show. We want to thank Jeep Trail Print Shop, a small local Chico screen printer that loves great design, small businesses, musicians, educators, and creative customers. Jeep Trail Print Shop specializes in water-based screen printing to bring your vision to life. More information at 530-415-6244 and at jeeptrailprint.com. And my Duffy's Tavern, located on the corner of 4th and Main in downtown Chico for over 30 years, Duffy has reopened, and indoor and outdoor seating. New hours are Wednesday through Sunday, 5 p.m. to 2 a.m. That's Duffy's Tavern. There's another 30 years ahead. Here's to another 30 years. There we go. Here's to it. Clink, clink. All righty. We're going to start with the little birthday intro, and then we'll get into the hard mix here. Thanks for tuning in to Playing Dead.